It's 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the State. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's, since I shorted you a minute on today's show, let's just dive right in and
okay.
Scrap
you
that
know, when
happy
you say
talk.
Dive at the same time as the Blue Angels are going to be flying today, I just have these momentary bursts of happy thoughts. But anyway.
Well, let's continue on that theme of happy. Because this week there was a bunch of articles with happy economic news.
Oh, I mean, we've been getting that all along. Little articles that say, oh, just about turned the corner. We've turned the corner and this may be the turn of the corner. You know, you keep getting these articles.
Right? Depression averted for another 3 minutes.
Yeah. And this week has been particularly bad. And I've been reading a lot of these articles because I want to see what they're basing this happy talk on, right? And what I'm finding is, and it's incredible, I read the headline, which will say something like PI's article, like the article in the PI yesterday that said, spending fuels economic surge, making it sound like the economy is just bursting out into massive growth, right? And you read the article, and it's based on very flimsy stuff. Now, I've seen some articles that have had very, very happy headlines, and then you read every single paragraph of the article has something in it that should make people worried, has almost nothing in it that indicates the economy is actually growing.
And what's fascinating for me is that when that appears in, say, the Wall Street Journal, you assume that it's going to be an audience, many of whose people know that the stuff
things
in every
are not
paragraph
so good.
Are not so good. So why even bother?
Yeah, it's very strange, and it's kind of surreal, too. But this article in the PI that everybody saw here in Seattle, and I'm assuming the Times probably ran something very similar, basically covered a tiny uptick in economic growth rate for the United States in this past quarter for April, May, and June. Now, if you really look at what that was based on, it was based on two things. The major portion of it was 70% of the total rise was due to military spending, primarily from the war in Iraq. Now, the rest of the growth came from cash that people got when they refinanced their mortgages because mortgage rates are so low. Now, if you ask yourself, is this a real economic recovery, you have to say, no, it's not. Because the war in Iraq, if we look back over the last quarter, the war in Iraq started on March 20th, I believe, was the day of the invasion. And the fighting went through almost the whole week of April. May 1st, George Bush gave his little... The month of April, yeah. George Bush gave his little speech on the aircraft carrier on May 1st. There were major military operations throughout May and June where they were trying to mop up elements of Ba'ath Party members and militia members and so forth. So a lot of money has been spent in Iraq on these various military, on the war and these various military operations. That's not going to continue. Even if the occupation is expensive, it's not going to be that expensive going forward. So that's not going to keep driving the U.S. economy. It's only accounted for a tiny uptick already. So if we look forward, you have to say, well, that's really a one-time occurrence. That's not really the basis for an economic recovery.
We're keeping our fingers crossed that's a one-time occurrence.
Yeah. I mean, there are 196 other countries out there. It's
Yeah, and that's the risk, is that the Bush administration sees this as the way to make the economy recover, and they want to keep running high federal deficits, which has its own risk, and I'll talk about that later. And they decide that we have to keep having another war and another war and another war. Now, the other piece that accounted for much of the growth this past quarter was the people who refinanced their mortgages. But mortgage rates just this past week or so have gone up. They're over 6% now. And if we look back at who's refinanced, about two-thirds of all homeowners who have a mortgage have already refinanced. The people who are left, a large portion of those are people who can't refinance for various reasons, mostly because their credit is not good enough. If they tried to refinance, they wouldn't get a good enough deal to make it worth their while. So mortgage refinancings have dropped a lot. And we look at statistics from the companies that issue mortgages, and you'll see that their applications levels have dropped considerably. So that's not going to be going into the future. And that has actually been, I think, the one thing that has propped up the economy more than anything else has been people refinancing their mortgages, getting a little extra cash back, going out and buying stuff now. So we might ask ourselves, okay, why are interest rates going up for mortgages? Okay, well, there's two reasons for that. One is the high federal deficits that throws a lot of the federal government to finance its debts has to issue bonds, treasury bonds and treasury notes and treasury bills. That floods the market with debt instruments. Then they have to raise rates in order to attract investors. So that drives interest rates up for bonds. At the same time, accounting scandals, we talked about this about a month and a half ago, accounting scandal with Freddie Mac, where Freddie Mac was caught moving some things around on their balance sheet, not booking their derivatives correctly so that they would smooth out their earnings over every quarter so that it wouldn't look like they'd have a wildly profitable quarter one quarter, and then the next quarter they would operate at a loss. So they were doing something that the SEC has long considered illegal, and in fact Microsoft got hit for doing the same thing and was sanctioned by the SEC. So Freddie Mac has these accounting scandals going on, and that has driven up mortgage rates significantly, because what Freddie Mac does is it essentially buys mortgages from banks, turns around, packages them into debt instruments or bonds that they can sell on the bond market. Now, when investors look at Freddie Mac, they think it's riskier now to buy their bonds, so they want a higher interest rate on those. So Freddie Mac has to pass that higher interest rate through to banks, which pass it through to you and I and your landlord and everybody else who has a mortgage. So that's what's driving the mortgage rates up: federal deficits and the accounting scandals at Freddie Mac.
All right, so
Really, the economy is far from recovering. That's your 5 or 10 minutes or so of economic unhappy talk to counter the 50, 60, 70 hours of economic happy talk you'll get the rest of the week.
Yes, and we do try to have like really depressing things to kick off people's Saturday mornings
That's
with
right.
on this program. It's sort of a feature here.
It is. Uh-huh. Let me ask you one other thing on the a year ago, have some corporate reforms that we should be all cashing in on now.
We did, and it was supposed to help the economy. Some of the Bush administration and Congress's corporate reforms. One of those pieces of reform was the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, was passed about a year ago. That was meant to regulate the accounting industry by setting up a new accounting oversight board. Now, George Bush did some other things. He threw some money at the Security and Exchange Commission, and Congress also held some hearings into Enron and WorldCom. And then Republicans said, well, gosh, the free market will regulate some of this. Some of these corporations will see, you know, how bad it was for Enron and WorldCom to go through bankruptcy and collapse, and they will clean it themselves up on their own. So it's good to look back and say, what has actually happened in a year? Has any of this actually occurred? Well, the Accounting Oversight Board is actually, a year later, still in the recruitment phase. They only have 60 employees. They need at least 200 by the end of the year. That's not going very well. They're running short of funds. They are operating on borrowed money from the Treasury, because the Sarbanes-Oxley Act specified that the Accounting Oversight Board would get money from the accounting industry to pay for its operations. Well, that's still a work in progress. And it's also puts a question into how much oversight the Accounting Oversight Board will be able to do if their largest funders are the largest accounting firms they're supposed to be regulating. And the SEC, likewise, has been having some trouble. The money they got from George Bush was not nearly enough for them to do the kind of investigating that they need to do to look at the financial statements of all of the companies that have quarterly filings with the SEC. There are a number of companies who have violated the main rule that the SEC issued last year, which was that all of the CEOs and upper-level corporate officers of publicly traded companies have to personally sign and certify quarterly financial statements issued by their companies. Many companies are not doing that, including our friend Quest. But the SEC has not been able to really enforce that rule. There's only one company that has been sanctioned for violating that rule, and that was only because that was such an egregious violation. The officers of HealthSouth certified financial a financial statement that was so grossly wrong that it couldn't be ignored.
Does Quest actually have a CEO at this point? They keep changing them, I think, every month or so.
Yeah, they do. They do.
Now who came in as head of the SEC? Because I remember that Bush had, I think, had an appointment that was kind of squirrely
I can't remember off the top of my head. It's been...
I mean, he's had many appointments.
He's had many appointments. But if we ask ourselves, too, the companies that were supposed to be sort of self-regulating, companies that were supposed to be looking at the WorldCom Enron disaster and saying, well, we got to clean up our act, you know, have they actually been doing that? Well, some of them have. A lot of them have stopped issuing pro forma statements where, and for folks who don't know what pro forma is, it's basically taking the balance sheet and subtracting a few items that you don't think are quite something that the shareholders should see because you think they're one-time things, or if you're corrupt, you think that if I just subtract these things, it'll make the company look better, and then shareholders will invest, and then it'll be good.
And these are expenses you're talking about, that they subtract expenses. They don't leave out earnings that they don't want the shareholders to see.
No, yeah. They largely leave out debt. That's the whole idea behind fiddling with the balance sheet. If you're not on the up and up, is that you're trying to leave debt items out of the mix. But, you know, they haven't been issuing as many pro forma statements, but they've been coming up with a lot of other little tricks to fiddle with the balance sheet, like Freddie Mac's not booking derivatives correctly. Or, for example, some companies are now doing a net debt figure where they take their cash on hand and subtract it from their total debt to come up with a number that's net debt, which is lower than their real debt. And the problem with that is your cash on hand often isn't used to pay debt. It's used to pay operating expenses, to pay big bills that are coming up in the future, to buy equipment. Sometimes banks will require you to have a certain amount of cash on hand all the time before they'll let you borrow money. So most companies don't use their cash to pay their debts. But when they subtract it from their total debt, they make it look as if they're actually in better shape than they are. So there's a lot of these little gimmicks still going around.
And sometimes it's specifically legally earmarked for particular purchases or other expenditures.
That's right. That's exactly right. So really, we're in pretty much the same situation we were a year ago. There's not much oversight. There's very little money to fund the SEC and no money from the government to fund the Accounting Oversight Board. They're basically operating on borrowed money and borrowed time, if you ask me. And the companies are not regulating themselves. That's where we're at a year later.
All right. Well, that doesn't sound like things are looking very good for us economically. And right this week when I hear that we might have had a new system that could get us all financially out of this on the Internet, this policy analysis market.
Yeah, we had a possibility for a way for ordinary day traders like you and me who think we know something about terrorism because we've been reading the daily headlines, you know, every day for the past at least since Bush was elected. And the policy analysis market was the brainchild of the folks at DARPA, the John Poindexter's agency in the Pentagon. It was actually scheduled to start yesterday on August 1st. This idea that you could essentially have a futures market on Middle East terrorist attacks and assassinations. When this hit the papers on Monday, it was leaked by some disgruntled staffers at the Pentagon, and people in Congress started jumping on it and pointing out the obvious, for one thing, that the terrorists themselves could finance future operations by betting correctly on their upcoming ones. The poop hit the fan, and within a few hours, the Pentagon had withdrawn this on Tuesday morning after it hit the news on Monday night. And lo and behold, by the end of the week, it turns out that that John Poindexter had been the head of the agency within the Pentagon, and he had personally signed off on this plan. Now, this is the same guy who had the idea for the massive computer database within the Pentagon, and actually there are several of these types of projects now underway in different arms of the government. But this massive, essentially cradle-to-grave computer database that would track all the different types of information that different government computers and information agencies track on every U.S. citizen, on every person in the United States. Everything from your birth records to your credit records, where you live, your medical records, your everything, all the way up until the time you die. And of course, for some odd reason, privacy advocates, civil liberties activists, and so forth were a bit concerned about the possibility for a government abuse of this database and the thought that governments might get this wrong. And Poindexter was the same thinking out of the box type guy who came up with the Iran-Contra, that not just implicated in the scheme, he thought of the scheme. He was the guy who thought up the idea of selling arms to terrorists, that is the government of Iran, which is now called an axis of evil, and that was just a few years after they had taken the hostages in 1978, I believe. And then using that to turn around and create an entire terrorist army in Central America, that being the Contras, because it was money from the United States government to finance that was barred by Congress at the time, so this was all under the table. That whole illegal scheme was his idea, and this is the sort of a background that is considered a character reference and an endorsement by the Bush administration. And lo and behold, by the end of the week, Poindexter resigns because he doesn't like the public attention. He doesn't like people criticizing his out of the box thinking. And it makes you wonder number one, how many other bright ideas. I mean, if this was greenlighted, what other ideas were rejected when this one was approved? But beyond that, it makes you wonder how many other people are working, the various Bush administration political appointees in the Pentagon, the DOD, the various other agencies that have tons of money flowing into them that we're not hearing about, that only when it's leaked and when it's this particularly outrageous is it going on. Poindexter is not the only alumnus of past Republican administration scandals that's working for the Bush administration now.
You have to wonder if John didn't lay down some money on a bet that he wouldn't last through the week.
Well, you wonder, for example, I mean, he funded an entire terrorist army in the past. Who's to say that, A, he didn't have connections of his own, or B, he didn't feel like being an expert on terrorism himself. He could make some money on the side on this thing.
Maybe he just felt out of the loop and wanted the market to get him up to speed.
Or he couldn't remember. Yeah, he didn't have an exact memory. But anyway, so it was, a lot of jokes were made about this, but it's a deadly serious kind of thing. And you wonder how people in the rest of the world perceive the arrogance of Americans making money and betting on other people's tragedies.
Mm.
You know, how would we feel if Saudis were holding bets on the next 9/11?
Well, speaking of that, there was a report that came out. I believe it was actually last week that it
yes,
came out.
Yes, it was. It came out late last week.
And apparently, as there's a rich tradition with the White House keeping portions of reports out of the public eye.
Yeah, I actually wrote a column on that came out on Tuesday at workingforchange.com, and lo and behold, the Seattle Times headline this morning and the New York Times and LA Times also have stories on it talking about the same thing. Just, I love being ahead of the curve. But it is the missing 28 pages. There are a number of redacted portions from what is nearly a 900-page report, a joint congressional commission that was studying 9/11, and this is not the Thomas Keene Commission, the commission that Henry Kissinger originally chaired, that is a broader investigation into the workings of 9/11 and the FBI and intelligence community. And most of the media coverage when this report came out last week was on the FBI and the CIA and their failings to talk with each other and act on tips and so forth. But there was another significant element to this report, and that was the question of foreign support and foreign government support for the 9/11 plot and for Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations around the world. And this is foreign support, but it was specifically foreign government support. And this was by far the largest section of the report that was redacted. It was 28 pages, and almost all of it we were learning by last weekend from high government, well-placed government officials, senior officials, as they say in the news accounts, concerned Saudi Arabia. And we're starting to get more details on this. It involves a couple of Saudis in particular, a guy named Omar al-Bayami and Osama Basnan, who were in the San Diego area in the year 2000, and another cleric who was in San Diego, who later moved to Northern Virginia outside Washington, D.C., and their contacts both with the Saudi government, and in fact, one of the areas of speculation was that al-Bayami was actually a Saudi intelligence officer, and at least two of the actual hijackers in 9/11, and the fact that the Saudi government was funneling enormous amounts of money to these two in the year 2000 and 2001. And it also detailed a number of other connections between the Saudi government and various officials in the Saudi government and various mostly indirect, mostly circumstantial links with al-Qaeda and with 9/11. But it raises a number of questions. It raises questions as to why the FBI had not even pursued, let alone found, a number of these links. In fact, there's a stunning quote in the report, which I didn't bring it verbatim for this morning, but it's in the column, talking about how not only did the FBI and CIA not prioritize the question of foreign sponsorship of this plot, but it didn't even seriously look at it until the commission came calling and started raising these questions. Now, this in particular is astonishing because the question of foreign sponsorship has essentially been driving American foreign policy for the last 2 years. Mm-hmm. You know, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, overthrew the Afghan government, the Taliban, on the basis that it harbored the people who plotted 9/11. We invaded Iraq, overthrew the government of Iraq, are now occupying the country of Iraq, and in many ways are trying to occupy Afghanistan as well, but occupying Iraq as well on the basis, as near as I can tell, of Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein both being Muslim. But at the same time, here you have a country that who has highly ranked government officials, and the Saudi royal family includes thousands of people, but it is a very nepotistic enterprise wherein they've been running Saudi Arabia for a number of years. Many of the companies that do business in Saudi Arabia are very closely linked to the Saudi royal family. The bin Laden family made its construction fortune based on its, you know, finances being heavily intertwined with the Saudi royals.
And it's a fundamentalist government.
And I'll get to that in a minute. It's very much a fundamentalist government. So you have, you have these very close links now with the plot, and of course we already knew, bin Laden himself is Saudi. Something like 13 of the hijackers, or more, I think actually were Saudi, but certainly the vast majority of them were Saudi. Yeah, you know,
15.
Yeah, that's right. The trail of al-Qaeda and of the 9/11 plot is basically a limited access freeway, and most of the exits are in Saudi Arabia, and yet it's been treated very much with kid gloves by the Bush administration. And when you start looking at this, you have to start looking at oil. You have to start looking at questions like, and of course, you know, the internet would love to make hay of things like the Carlyle Group and the Bush family's direct personal connections with the grand poobahs of Saudi Arabia and the oil industry there. But, you know, even if you don't have those direct links, you have the Saudi government, which has one of the worst human rights records in the world. They're every bit as fundamentalist and repressive to women and, all the rest of it as the Taliban ever were. And yet the Washington has looked the other way for decades because of the oil, and the Bush administration has very much looked the other way. Because of this, the investigation into 9/11 has apparently until very recently looked the other way. And I think you have to ask some questions at least as hard on this as you do around the questions of weapons of mass destruction. You know, are senior government officials at best choosing to hear only what they want to hear, and at worst deliberately suppressing
suppressing information and forcing the world to look the other way by invading unrelated countries afterwards, because they don't want people paying attention to where the origins of the 9/11 plot actually were.
Well, speaking of invading unrelated countries, it was interesting watching the Senate hearing this week. Paul Wolfowitz was taking some heat over the U.S. actions happening in Iraq. Did you catch that?
Oh, he really was.
Very much.
I didn't actually see the hearing, but I read about it afterwards, and I was really surprised to be reading these news reports that usually have softballed these hearings. I mean, they'll mention a couple of critical comments, but they'll say basically focus on what Rumsfeld or Wolfowitz or whoever is addressing the Senate or House committee said, and really play up the Bush policy. Well, this time around, when I was reading the news reports, they just showed the bipartisan attack against Wolfowitz, saying, "What, you know, when is the U.S. government going? When is the Bush administration going to lay out a budget for how much it's going to cost for this occupation? And what do you mean you haven't found any weapons of mass destruction? Didn't we go to war for that reason? And how can you sit there and tell me that this is a link in the war on terrorism when we can't even see any link between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden?" So it was amazing because it was coming from both sides of the aisle, both the Democrats and the Republicans. I mean, the Democrats were really going at him, but the Republicans were also in for the kill.
And one of the other encouraging things about this is you had the whole flurry, or, you know, in July about weapons of mass destruction and the 16 words in the State of the Union, and that had pretty much died out of the news cycle. And you had the concern that this issue was going to go away in America's very short political memory. And the effect of this and the tone of the news coverage suggests that this is not going to go away. This is going to continue to hound the Bush administration, just as the actual occupation is going to continue to go even more and more sour.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we're going to actually be airing tomorrow morning from 6 to 7 some excerpts from that Senate hearing. So
people want to hear Wolfowitz get himself reamed.
Oh, and believe me, it's tremendously entertaining. Huh? Uh-huh.
So we only have a couple minutes left. Can you tackle very, very quickly telling us about a couple of the candidates that we might see on our ballots this fall?
Yeah, and we'll certainly talk about this more in weeks to come. But the filing deadline was yesterday for local elections coming up this fall. And there were a couple of surprise names that came in the last minute. Brian Drodowski, a former Republican King County councilman over on the east side, filed for the seat again against the man who displaced him, David Irons. He filed this time as a Democrat, so he will survive until the general election. He has 3 months to campaign rather than 1 month. And Jean Godden, Seattle Times columnist. Actually, it was very funny in the Times this morning. She was described as a Times columnist who was going to resign her job in the PI. They called her the former Times columnist. A little marketing twist going on there. But she's going to go after Judy Nicastro, along with several other people who have already lined up to try and go after Judy Nicastro. And Judy is not going to be nearly as easy to displace as people seem to think she is. She's already raised $140,000. Although, on a related note, the FBI is also looking into the strip club joint funding that Nicastro and Jim Compton and Heidi Wills are all implicated in. And then we have several exciting school board candidates that we'll be talking about, and monorail board and other things coming up too. So we'll look at that more in the weeks to come.
Very good. Well, with that, we are out of time. Talking again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat the State. And tell people where they can find Eat the State.
It is a biweekly publication that comes out free. You can find it wherever you find free publications, at bookstores and cafes and, good places like that. It has a wonderful calendar on the back that will give you upcoming events. Probably have copies floating around tomorrow at the anarchist picnic, because, of course, there are some anarchists who, some anarchists hate Eat the State, but some anarchists work for it, so go figure. That, by the way, is tomorrow afternoon from 1:30 to 5 with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs fame, and October 22nd and various other places. I think Pam Africa will also be at that. That is at the Cascade People Center.
No, she won't be there.
She won't be there. But anyway, 1:30 to 5 at Cascade People Center. Sorry.
And that's over at Pontius and Thomas Street.
Yeah, Cascade People's Center. Anyway,
Eat the State. Also on the web, www.eatthestate.org, and it is a volunteer-driven publication, so if you want to volunteer or if you have story tips or feedback or whatever, give us a call. The voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.
Okay.